Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. My name is Anthony and I'm your host. As we wrap up season 4, I have a number of excerpts of several conversations. Jen Doolittle Wilson is back, Arthur Jamfa, Elio Garcia, comic Steve Osborne. But before any of that, here is Dr. Chad Carmichael.
One other thing I want to bring up, Ned is so high-minded about killing a 14-year-old girl. But, like, you never get any sense that he's wringing his hands over what happened to that butcher's boy.
No, you don't. Yeah. Do you think that there's a class thing? Class difference?
Maybe. I guess that's the only explanation I can think of. It doesn't really ring true to me. It's almost like maybe Ned's honor, his concern with the honor is not as sincere as it may seem.
That could be the case.
So more than, in other words, more than class, it's like this. It's like people like Robert, people in the small council will see Ned as this kind of frustrating, honor-bound guy if he stands up against the plot to kill Daenerys. But that's not going to be their reaction if he's carrying on about the murdered butcher's boy.
Well, it's not wasn't a premeditated thing with the butcher's boy. It was sort of like... Yeah.
That's true.
The hound is a mad dog, and he ran down the butcher's boy, and you know what? Mad dogs do what mad dogs do.
But the hound was never disciplined for that.
Right. Yeah. You're totally right. You're totally right that Ned needs to show more indignation about what happened to Micah.
And I think it's not so much class as it is he wants them to think that he's a frustrating, honor-bound guy. And maybe he doesn't like the way that they would think of him if he stood up for the butcher's boy. I don't know what they would think about him. They would probably think he was crazy or something.
Right.
They wouldn't think, oh, Ned, he's so frustrating, he's so honor-bound, if he was standing up for the butcher's boy, right? They'd be like, why do you care about him?
Well, and I so mean, it is Ned's image. Job. Ned's job is to care about the people of the North.
Yeah.
Right? So part of his job is to make sure that innocent children don't just get run down by rogue soldiers or whatever. But here's the thing about this. Is that the story is that Micah attacked the crown prince. Yeah. So they sent a killer to go bring him back and he brought him back dead. And it's a crazy situation, but no one sort of sat in a high council room and planned Micah's death.
But Ned knows that's not what happened.
Well, I know. I guess that's what I'm saying. I think maybe we're on the same page here. I think that Ned should be sort of indignant about the butcher's boy and say, hey, he was one of mine. He was my daughter's friend. And why did he have to die? And, you know, all that business. But he doesn't do it. And it's a curious situation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it has something to do with Ned's display of indignation and concern with honor being less genuine than he would like us to think it is.
But it is somewhat different than the situation with Dany. You know, she's a 14-year-old girl. And she's across the sea.
Yeah.
And she may be pregnant, but she really does not pose any threat.
Right.
He just thinks that planning an assassination is repugnant.
Right.
So it is a different sort of context than Micah's context.
I wonder how he would have reacted if Robert had said, bring me the butcher boy's head.
I think he would have protested, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably true. That's probably true. But then he just lets it go when it happens. It's weird. It's weird.
It's not as weird as Ned caring so little about serial killers like Gregor Clegane.
Yeah.
He's clearly a serial killer and Ned just kind of shrugs it off.
Ned shrugs it off. Nothing to be done about it.
There's nothing. Hey, let me ask you a question, that I don't think I've asked you before.
Okay.
You've been a good sport about covering these Ned chapters for me in a way I don't think many other people could do, because I just don't think people get Ned in the way that you seem to get Ned.
Yeah.
Or you're willing to defend Ned from time to time.
Yeah.
When others wouldn't. but if there was another character another POV chapter character.
Sure.
That you would like to cover.
Yeah.
And sort of break out of the Ned pigeonhole.
Yeah.
Who would it be?
I mean, you know, my favorites are the same favorites everybody has, I guess, Tyrion and Arya.
Not necessarily. You're a little, you're kind of an odd bird when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Everybody loves Tyrion and Arya. If you ask everybody's favorite, almost half of the people are going
to
be Tyrion.
You know, it's funny to me what response I get. I get Dany a lot.
Uh-huh.
And I do get Arya and I do get Tyrion. And those are very common, right?
Yeah.
Every now and again, I'll get Sansa. I've talked to two people on this podcast that said, no, Sansa, she's the one that I love.
That's crazy. I feel sorry for Sansa. I don't like her. I don't like Bran very much. He seems like kind of a little jerk. I guess Catelyn, I don't really like. She seems kind of dumb to me in an annoying way.
Oh, you are so wrong about this.
I know. You have a thing about Catelyn.
I'm a little bit shocked.
I like John and Dany both. I like the characters a lot. A lot. I like them a lot.
I think you would be a good John coverage guy.
Sure, I could do that. I'm more interested in what's going on in the Seven Kingdoms and in King's Landing. So I always, when it goes to Dany or John, I always feel like I'm getting taken out of the action a little bit.
But I think you'd be a good John guy.
I would really do any chapter. So you can name the chapter and I'd be happy to.
Well, you're absolutely not doing a Catelyn chapter. You've shown me your ass on that one, Chad.
Right. Right. I think that she,
just don't. Why don't you just stop right there?
Her impulsive, vengeful, like maternal instincts drive everything she does. And it really causes a lot of ruin.
That doesn't mean she's dumb.
Well, it just means she's, I mean, maybe there's an intellect there that's just not engaged, but.
Let me tell you about Catelyn Stark.
Mm-hmm.
She takes Tyrion and she tells everyone in the room that she's going to take him to Winterfell. Instead, she takes him to the Eyrie. And when Tyrion realizes what she's done.
Yeah.
He says that she has outthought him at every turn.
Uh-huh.
Tyrion is supposed to be the smartest person in the book.
Yeah.
And from Tyrion's perspective, Catelyn Stark has outwitted him.
Yeah.
So I do think that that you're wrong. I don't think it makes you a bad person. You can be wrong and, you know, still be a good person.
She made a good move in tricking Tyrion. But that's in the context that she's wrongly imprisoned the guy. He's like one of the better people in the situation. He probably would have helped her.
Yeah, she's being played by Littlefinger for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, and I hate Littlefinger. That's why I dislike Catelyn, is because she's played by Littlefinger throughout, and I don't like it. I don't like him, and I'm frustrated with her that she goes with that. And it seems like she's driven too much by her desire for revenge and her self-concern.
Wrong.
Well,
totally wrong.
There you go.
Thanks again, man.
All right.
As always, I appreciate you.
All right.
At the midpoint, Tyrion's imprisonment at the Eyrie is revealing more elements about his character. Jan Doolittle Wilson talks about this alongside a discussion of Cersei. Here is Jan Doolittle Wilson.
You know, Bronn is another great example, I think, of someone who is not at all invested in the wars of the great houses. He's out for Bronn. He's out for his own survival, and he'll be loyal to anyone who is able to do something for him.
Yeah, talk about a survivor, but he's sort of an opportunistic survivor.
Yes.
And
I love Bronn.
And Tyrion is sort of, yeah, right. I was just saying this to a friend the other day, like, you know, the Hound is a murdering son of a bitch.
Yeah.
But I want to watch him. I just can't take my eyes off him.
Oh, the Hound. We could talk forever about the Hound, too. I mean, yeah, there are so many characters like that who are really just despicable. Mm. Right? I mean, they're just, they, again, do horrible things, or they're just really despicable people. Yeah. And yet you're pulled in their direction in ways that you just don't anticipate as you go through. And I think, you know, certainly the Hound is a great example of that. Yeah. I mean, we're given his backstory pretty early on.
The Hound, you know, is, yeah, that's right. That's right. He tells,
we're kind of meant to sympathize pretty early on.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Bronn, I think that this is something of an introduction. We see that little flicker of a friendship between Tyrion and Bronn.
Yes.
When Tyrion makes Bronn laugh.
Yes.
And Tyrion thinks, this is a start. Well, it is something of a start of a, of kind of an important relationship, even if it's sort of this relationship built out of commerce, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
Anyway, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the sad part about this to me, in thinking about Bronn and thinking about Shay, I have lots of thoughts about Shay, but Tyrion, I think, has, other than, again, Jaime, Tyrion has experienced really only these kinds of relationships where this person is with me because they are getting something out of it. Mm. They're with me because I pay them. They're with me because I have family name and standing. They're not really with me for me. They're not with me because they love me. They're not with me because they enjoy my company. There is always that, even with Bronn, right? When he and Bronn establish this great camaraderie, there is still that feeling in the back of his mind, well, if I wasn't paying him, he probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah.
And that may be true. True for Bronn, but,
and same with Shay,
know,
right?
This with Shay, yeah. Right? Where she's saying, oh, my lion of, you know, Lannister, mm-hmm. and my great one, and I love you. And he's thinking, oh, she must, no, she doesn't, right? How could she love you?
Yeah. How would he ever know? It's like,
how would he ever know? Yeah. How can he ever be sure that somebody is with him for him? Mm-hmm. Given his history and, you know, given just the abuse that he faced his entire life growing mm-hmm. up, you know, he says it again and again, if I had not been born a Lannister, I would have been left out in the woods to die. And yeah. It's probably true.
That's right. That's right.
His father wanted to throw him into the sea, right, when he was born. So he has this great mistrust as well. You know, this he knows,
yeah, a well-earned mistrust, right?
A well-earned mistrust.
Hmm.
But you're right that I think, especially when you get to the next chapter, he and Bronn are riding side by side and laughing and joking, and even Catelyn is thinking, "Huh, mm-hmm. I'm not sure Bronn should be with this party." The two of them are bonding in ways that they really shouldn't be, given that Bronn is supposed to be the person helping me capture mm-hmm. Tyrion and take him to justice. And of course, her suspicions are proven to be true when Bronn stands up for him and fights for him.
That's right. That's right.
Which is a great moment too.
It's such a great moment. And it's Tyrion thinking, I have so little to work with here.
Yeah.
But here I have this weapon in that I can make this guy laugh.
Yes.
And I'm going to use it to, you know, to my own benefit, because, you know, here I, you know, it's a survivor's mentality.
And think about, it does pay off.
Yeah.
He was absolutely right. He makes Bronn laugh in this chapter, and look how that pays off.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's that humor. It's that I'm going to plug into whatever narrative is going on and find out what makes people light up. And that's how I'll use it. And so Tyrion's a user too,
yes.
But I think Tyrion's perpetual Achilles heel, if you want to put it that way, is he wants to be loved, right? He does care what people think. Mm-hmm. He desperately wants approval. He constantly makes, you know, remarks about his father, but he desperately wants his father's approval. One even gets the hint that he wants Cersei's approval. He just wants to be loved.
Yeah.
And when it doesn't happen, you can see that deep hurt, you know, again and again and again. Humiliation, but also hurt.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you, since we've talked about Tyrion and Jaime?
Yeah.
I can't help myself but ask your impression of Cersei. And specifically with the fact that, you know, she presents as villainous almost through the entire series up until we have it. But then she gets a POV later in the series.
Right.
So she becomes a point of view character later in the series. And how do you, now that we've seen a little bit of her interior, how do you read Cersei? I think a lot of people will read Cersei as sort of just a straight villain. And I think that that's kind of how I read Cersei. And yet I think that there might be a tiny little bit of latent misogyny that goes into that reading.
Yeah. Yeah. She's another fascinating character. I was so happy when she finally got her own, you know, point of view chapters later on. I hope that's something George continues. I agree on the one hand that she's extremely villainous.
Yeah.
Would I describe her as a straight up villain? Maybe not. You know, just like Tyrion is born into a world that was not at all made for him, right? Cersei was too. You know, she has tons of privileges, tons of advantages. She also draws on her family name and her wealth and, you know, to great effect. But how often does Cersei say, you know, if I had been born a man, if I had been born a boy, you know, if I were a Lannister son, how different would my life be? How different would I be treated by my father? What choices would be available to me? And so she's very much aware that, you know, I think Cersei maybe gives herself a little too much credit for her smarts. I think, you know, Tyrion outsmarts her a lot, but on the other hand, she hasn't really been allowed to develop her cleverness or her intellect, right? She was bred for a very particular purpose. Mm-hmm. That is to look pretty, to get married and bear sons, right? And continue the line.
And used, and used in a way that grated against the core of her being, right?
Yes.
So Jaime is used by Tywin in a way that kind of grates against him. Like, he doesn't really want to be the Lord of Casterly Rock. Mm-hmm. But in a lot of ways, Jaime is used in a way that feels really comfortable to him. Like, I like being, you know, best sword in the kingdom, bringing glory to my house, that kind of thing. Yeah. Whereas Cersei is used in a way that just is completely violent to her sense of being. For the benefit of her family, she's used in a way that is completely self-sacrificial.
Yes.
So
and
then the question
has nothing
is,
to do with her, right? It's all about what she can bring to the family. Right. I mean, that's Tywin's whole philosophy. But, you know, she describes herself at one point as just a brood mare. She's passed
around.
That's
how she feels.
That's how she feels. And also think about the idea that, and, you know, there's the idea of choice, and Cersei makes terrible choices.
Yeah.
She's responsible for the choices she makes. However, had she been treated with more kindness, perhaps, right, by particularly the men who have power over her. So had she been allowed to marry the man she was attracted to in the form of Rhaegar, right, if she had not been kind of pressured into a loveless marriage, if Robert had been kinder to her. Right. I mean, on her wedding night, he whispers the name of another woman.
That's
it was
right.
clear to her from the very first moment. Maybe if she had been treated with more respect and kindness, she wouldn't have been so vengeful and made some of the choices that she made. So, you know, yes, she was born with great wealth and privilege. She has responsibility. But in terms of how she sees, you know, men and patriarchy and power, her entire life, she's been bashing against this because it's done nothing but use her and exploit her. It has never taken her into consideration.
Right.
Jamie's the only one who has. And that's deeply problematic,
right,
their relationship.
Sure.
But Jamie, much like with Tyrion, is the only one to show her tenderness and kindness and to put her needs before, you know, the needs of others, which also leads to terrible choices. Mm-hmm. But that's really the only form of affection, other than her children, of course, that she has experienced.
And yet, this entire conversation could just be a way of showing that Martin can write an interesting villain, right?
Yes.
I think a lot of villains, a lot of great stories have interesting villains that you could see how they came to think that the way that they do. and how they came by their sort of ignoble actions honestly. Or at least you can kind of empathize with, you know, the plight of the villain in a way that complicates the story and makes it a better story, right?
And how fraught that relationship and that divide is between hero and villain,
yes,
right? What makes someone a hero, what makes someone a villain in Martin's world, those two boundaries are constantly crossed, right? They're constantly transgressed. You know, our villains can be heroes. Our heroes can be villains. There's really no, other than maybe a Ned character who is pretty flat, right, in his characterization. Most of these characters continually kind of cross those borders. And that's what makes them so interesting.
Yeah.
You know, why is Tyrion a hero and Jaime's a villain? Why is Cersei a villain? And, you know, who gets to decide that? And maybe, again, that goes back to authorial intent.
Right, I
is
do.
It George Martin who decides that, or do we decide that?
We do.
Why
you and
I
get
say,
to decide.
You know what? Yeah, Jaime's a hero. This is why Jaime's a hero. And somebody else could just vociferously disagree with me. And who's to say who's correct? Mm. That's what makes these stories so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. For more on the politics and plot points at the Eyrie, here is Arthur Jamfa.
I also think that we, like, one of the things that struck me when I was reading this was, wait, the Sky Cells aren't prison, they're torture. Right.
That's right. Absolutely.
They're torture chambers. So they're nothing like a dungeon. And so that's what kind of pushes him to desperation, because he's getting tortured. Mm. He thinks, you know, I'd rather, you would, right? If you're getting tortured for 2 weeks, eventually you're like, well, I would rather gamble my life than continue to go through this torture. And
that's right.
And another way that he's really good is that he exposes in front of everyone the fact there's a torture chamber, right? He says, is this how you do justice in the Vale? And then he describes the way that he's treated, and everyone can tell.
And he shows everyone at court that he's been he's been hit. He's got bruises on his face, right?
Exactly. And tells him he hasn't eaten, and so it becomes apparent what they're doing, and that it's So I think that's why I think he's gambling. I don't think Tyrion would be someone that, if he could just wait for Jaime Lannister, wouldn't wait for Jaime Lannister. But I think it becomes quite clear that if he stays longer in the Sky Cells, he would die quite quickly.
Yeah, and I think that it's an educated gamble. He knows, because he's a lord, or he has lordly status or whatever, that he's a nobleman, that they're going to treat him differently. They have to treat him with some amount of dignity, because he's not just a garden variety prisoner, right? So that's part of his gamble, is that if he demands a trial, if he shows up the Knights of the Vale to be dishonorable for allowing this torture to happen, that they will respond because of his status as a nobleman.
I think at this point in the book, when he says that he's not convinced that they're not going to kill them, you don't believe him. You think they can't possibly kill him. But I think once you've read more of Martin's work, you realize that actually he could just die.
That's interesting, because I was thinking, yes, I was thinking that along those lines, but then I was thinking, I also don't trust that Lady Lysa or Sweet Robin are going to be politically savvy enough not to kill him. Because they're portrayed as batshit crazy, right? Or just not as smart enough to play that kind of game. And so I think Tyrion thinks they may just send me through the moon door just to do it.
I think Book Lysa is very intelligent, though. Unlike Show Lysa, which I think is portrayed as quite crazy, just quite erratic. I think Book Lysa controls the court of the Eyrie in a way that no other lord or lady does. And I think she's trying to kill, she is trying to kill Tyrion quite clearly, because I think she's trying to pin the death of her husband on him to try and make sure that no one suspects her. And if he dies, he
can't defend himself. And that's right. And if her son, who's 6 years old, is the judge of this trial, which he thinks is going to happen if he demands a trial, then she can basically claim like, hey, it wasn't me. The gods decided.
Yeah, exactly.
Or, you know, he had a fair trial. He was judged by the Lord of the Realm or the Lord of the Eyrie to be guilty. It just, we went through due process. Or once he demands trial by combat, she's thinking, well, the gods have decided. So they can't pin this on me. This is not, we did not mistreat him. He had a fair trial. So I think that you're probably right that she's certainly smarter than she's portrayed in the show. But I think from Tyrion's perspective, I don't think he quite knows her motives. I don't think he knows what she is capable of. And so I think he's fearing for his life, right?
I think he believes that she's on the same page as Catelyn is, right? She's trying to get to the truth. Therefore, he believes, if I keep risking my life, I probably won't die, because if I die, then the truth dies with me, or whatever it is. And that's why Catelyn doesn't want him to die, right? She says, if he's dead, he's only good for the crows. But actually, the reason why Lysa messes it up is because she keeps trying to get him killed, because she's not trying to get to the truth. She's trying to bury the truth.
Interesting. So I want to talk about that a little bit here.
Yeah.
Tyrion is sort of musing over his accusations. He's being accused of two things. He's being accused of attempting to kill Bran, right? And he's accused of murdering the Hand of the King, right?
Yes.
And as he's in the cell, he's thinking over these two murders or attempted murders, and he notices that the person who tried to kill Bran was clumsy. Like this was a horrible attempt at assassination.
Mm.
But that the person who killed Arryn was deft. Like this, that was a, whoever did the first murder, that person is smart. Whoever tried to kill Bran was not smart. And at that point, he wonders, I wonder if there's more beasts in the woods than the direwolf and the lion. Yeah, in other words, he's thinking, there's no way these two murders were done by the same person. And moreover, he thinks, it was probably one of my siblings who tried to kill Bran. He said, they're so stupid that it's probably them behind the botched murder of Bran. But it has to be someone who's not a Lannister who killed Robert Arryn. And that's when he wonders if it's some other person who's trying to use him as a cat's paw, right? He doesn't know it's Lysa. Of course, we know in retrospect she's at least part of it, right? She's at least part of the plot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, to your point, in retrospect, we totally see that Lysa is trying to pin it on him because she's covering up her own sin, right?
Yeah, and I think it's something I when you read the Catelyn chapter that comes afterwards, that really strikes you, is that all of these hints are getting dropped about there is something weird about Lysa going on here. And it goes back to what we said about the atmosphere that Martin is setting. And in the Eyrie, is that something is not as it seems. Everyone is playing a game. So what is actually going on? What's going on is definitely not what we're seeing. We don't, at this point in the book, we don't know what we're seeing.
And now Steve and I talk about our top five wow moment deaths in the first four seasons. And Steve and I answer listener feedback. Here is comic Steve Osborne. Hello.
Hello.
I'm going to send you a text.
Okay.
sending you a list.
Okay.
Steve, I just sent you a list by way of text message.
Yes.
Have you received it?
I have.
Would you read the list for us?
Yes. Joffrey. Is it Viserys? Viserys?
Yeah, you got it. Viserys.
Shay. Lysa. Red Wedding. Tywin. Ygritte. Oberyn. And Ned.
What these have in common, these represent dramatically horrific deaths.
Right.
What I'd like to do is I would like to rank the top five effectively horrific deaths, or let's say effectively surprising deaths.
Okay.
If those are two different things.
Sure. Yeah, I think so.
All right. So I'm going to start with my fifth highest.
Okay.
On this list.
So yeah, because like we're talking horrific and we're talking about shocking, right? So those are two different things.
Yeah, I think effectively dramatic.
Okay.
I think.
Yeah, because horrific, because it could be a subtle death.
Sure,
But with a large impact and maybe a surprise that it happened.
I think it's sort of like a wow death. Like,
sure.
I can't believe they killed that person. I was not expecting that. And, oh, shit, what's going to happen now?
Right.
So let's call this a wow death.
Sure.
I think my fifth highest is Lysa.
Yeah.
Because so far, Littlefinger really hasn't done anything with his own hands.
Right. That's true.
He's like Lex Luthor. He's like behind the scenes. He's using his mind to like outmaneuver everybody. And you really get the sense, like I got the sense that he had just arrived at the Eyrie like 2 seconds ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Like he just came in, he like wiped off his feet and he walked right up to Lysa and said, "I've always loved one woman. Your sister, Kat," and pushes her out of the moon door.
I know. Why does he got to throw that shade right out there? Like, I mean, and in the Littlefinger voice. I mean, can you imagine that being the last voice you hear before you die?
That's the worst part.
Yeah, you're, and to find out that like he's telling you, like he's breaking up with you.
Yeah.
I mean, that's no good.
Right. Because he should be grateful.
Yeah. You're right? What? Littlefinger, man. It's in your name.
All right. What was your number five?
Shay.
Yeah. Was it because of who did it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So she did this, you know, she sold him out in court, right? And that sort of sends him through the spiral where he just starts basically talking all kinds of trash to the entire King's Landing.
Yeah.
But there was, you know, we discussed this, like how and why and how do we get there? Like, so like there's more to the Shay story than we have to assume. It wasn't just because like he broke up. Like we felt like there was more to their relationship and even the breakup. That was understood, right? So Shay.
You know what was crazy about that is just the fact that she was in Tywin's bed made me question everything I knew about Tywin.
Right. Well, yeah.
Because I thought, I know this guy's a villainous. I know he's a horrible, you know, father. I didn't know he was totally full of bullshit.
Yeah. No. Right. I mean, so when you see her there, it's like that's so jarring, and I didn't see Tyrion killing her in that scenario. I didn't, like, there was so much like the abruptness in which it goes down with no resolution. Right. So it's another one of those, if she had never died or she'd never even come back, like I think I could have lived with it and just had it be just sort of this echo in Tyrion's, subconscious that, you know, like of losing love and never having closure on why she turned on him. Like that would have also been an okay narrative. But to have him now murder her, it sets a whole a different set of things in motion, right? Because Tyrion now is, I mean, that's the thing, is like, we talk about, you know, Jaime pushing Bran out a window. Mm-hmm. There's all these different mm-hmm. things. And it's like, and I don't know if it's because of the circumstance or because of how we've all just, we're committed to enjoying Tyrion at all costs. It's an easy one to kind of walk away from. Be like, oh, well, you know, life is hard for Tyrion. You know, it's like, but it's a pretty rough thing and complicated further by his I'm sorry. So it's like, that's a collection of, and so it does bring up the, like, he doesn't kill Tywin, I don't think, right?
No, that doesn't happen if he doesn't kill
So that, I mean, if you talk about like the cascading events, right? And it's interesting, like, so for me, it's almost a chronology at this point, right? So Oberyn doesn't die. He's set free. Who knows if he ever finds out about the Shae Tywin thing and if
right.
what his response is going to be, because there's not that other level of desperation.
Right. Okay, my fourth highest is going to be Oberyn.
Okay.
It felt like Oberyn was, I mean, he had convinced me that he was the better man in that fight.
Right.
It not only was it surprising, but it was like the whole skull popping business.
Yeah.
I mean, it was gruesome. It was sort of like not caught me by surprise, but also caught me by the sort of the horror meter of it.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. That was actually when I'm going through this list, I had him as well. And it's similar to I was surprised because it really seemed like that was the, you know, I mean, that was Tyrion's get out of jail free card, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that was, he wins, Tyrion is free, and it complicates everything, right? It complicates that family dynamic. It complicates Tyrion now is out, but what can you do? No one can do that. Cascading of events seemed pretty intriguing. And because Oberyn would seem like anybody seems like an underdog to the mountain, it felt like he wins. Like, I mean, there was a lot about it that just seemed like he was going to win. And then as it went on, like, it became a little more clear that, like, oh, he's Bond villaining, right? And that's what we discussed.
Yeah.
And so,
well, and it was sort of like, this is the guy that is gonna, he's no rival to the mountain. This guy's true rival is Tywin.
Right.
So he has to live to at least fight Tywin.
Right, right. So there's all these different aspects of, like, he won't get killed here. And then right when you start to think, oh, he might, oh my gosh, he's gonna get killed here, they get you with the pop. So right when you think you're like, you've already arrested the fact, like, oh my gosh, you may actually lose this thing, and then it was like, okay, here's some more surprise for you. You know, pop his head. So it was a gift they kept on giving in terms of surprising and horrific.
My number three on my list is Tywin. And the reason why Tywin is that I think he may be the one character that's more interesting in the show than he is in the books. Oh. Like, he's a formidable character in the books, but the Charles Dance, the guy who plays Tywin, he's forever Tywin Lannister, and he just was so compelling. Like, he stole every scene he was in.
Right.
And so even though I knew his death was coming, I had fallen in love with just that portrayal of Tywin on the screen much more so than I did on the pages.
Interesting. So
for me, Tywin's number three.
That's pretty solid. Yeah. I remember, like, of all the, like, the characters, like I just was like, what do we do now when Tywin died? Like, and it's weird because, you know, he's definitely not a guy you're rooting for per se, but he held so much together. And
yeah.
And it did feel like as soon as you eliminate him,
yeah, going back to my love for compelling villains. I mean, who was a more compelling villain?
Right, because I mean, you had crazy you've had vicious, you've had all, but like in terms of tactical and to a certain degree, he really believes what he's doing. Like, he believes what he's doing is right. And I bet he would tell you straight out, like, oh no, this is some vile stuff I'm doing, but it's the right thing to do. And that's what makes a villain even like the most compelling is when, you know, it's one thing to sow the seeds of chaos, but it's another thing to do it because you truly believe that what you're doing is the right thing.
Yeah, he's Thanos.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next.
I kind of, you know, it's funny because it's like there, it feels like Joffrey should get some attention.
Was quite jarring.
It was jarring. It was, and I think the most jarring part about it was when it happened, right? Yeah, like in terms of like when it happened in the season.
Yeah, like episode 2 of that season.
Right. So that, I think that part about it, which was great. It's a great moment for the show and just in general, because what it did was it got you out of your rhythm. Right. And Joffrey's such he's the guy who chops Ned's head off. He's a big deal.
Yeah.
But there's also this sense of like, you knew that, I guess my feeling is like his death had less of maybe an overarching impact going forward. Cause like nobody's like, we must avenge Joffrey. Right.
Yeah, right.
It causes a problem. Obviously, it causes a problem for Tyrion and on it goes. But in terms of like the vacuum of leadership, you know, so which is part of what makes this dance so compelling.
All right. So you're number two.
Red Wedding.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Yeah, it's just it's jarring. It's massive. It breaks rules. But you know, it's funny because there was an inevitability to it, you know, that I don't think you appreciate until it's actually unfolding.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I don't think either one of us would have said Rob, Catelyn, and Talisa, like those are characters I can't do without, right?
Right.
But just the fact that they can take those three characters and wipe them off the board summarily, and right. The fact that Arya was right at the gates,
yeah.
She was just about to be reunited, you know, that whole business, it's amazing what they did with, they made us feel about those characters in retrospect.
Right.
That they were more important than they were when they were alive.
Yeah, because they always felt necessary but not compelling. Like there was this, like, okay, we're gonna, you know, what's Rob doing? All right, like check that box.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rob and Catelyn tension that was building was like, all right, fine. You know, it was real and necessary, right? Like it complicated things. So I think also what's happening is, if I'm remembering correctly. The political intrigue is really ramping up. And so you're really investing in the five king concept.
That's right. And Rob, of all of the five kings, was the good guy, right?
Right. He was the good guy, or at least was it. And he was doing well, right? And so he was a threat. Mm-hmm. And there was all these different aspects to how it fit into the overall picture. That's when like the three of them getting wiped out, where the sum became, you know, greater than the individual parts, right? Like because of what it laid to waste and the after.
Yeah, it changed everything. It changed the entire landscape of the
It plot, changes right? The focus of Tywin's. I got to deal with this Rob guy, the king of the North. Now the North is up for grabs, and I think you can appreciate what happens, not so much maybe because of who they are, because what they represented, because the show did do a good job of creating the political landscape and where that fit in, where Rob's ascendance fit in, to have it just completely wiped out was bonkers. And again, the way they did it, the way that it was, it's an incredible scene, musically, the way that it's shot, performances are fantastic.
All right, I'm assuming both of us have Ned as our number one.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously, without it, I mean, it happens, you know, season one.
It happened before we really knew what Game of Thrones could do, right?
Right. Yeah, because and so it, we, we see where it's building. There was a way to get out of it. It seemed like, you know, he didn't have, the tension felt like getting up to the point where now you're ruining reputation and everything like that. That in and of itself would have created a cascade of events, right? So the impact of just not only just his family, but like everything, right? And it's fascinating when you really look back on it now, especially having seen what all this has brought. It was just Joffrey being a dick.
Joffrey just on a whim, just deciding, no, I don't like the look of his face.
Right. And now, and then, because even, Cersei was obviously has all this, like, you know, badness in her heart. But like, that was a moment too, where all of a sudden everything just spirals out of control. And she knows enough to be like, okay.
Yeah. Everyone is just totally going nuts.
Yeah.
Including Cersei.
Yeah. Because on one hand, it's like, because it's a twofold thing. One is, oh, how do we deal with this now? And also, oh, my son is worse than I thought. But so it's like, it's again, it's another element of like, who's left? You know, it becomes that too, is right. Who's left to start running things? Because are we gonna be rooting for, like, is the next best person we have? Like, I mean, you have Danny, but then like, is it?
Yeah. By the end of the series, everyone will be dead, but Ramsay, and you'll be like, well, I guess I'm rooting for Ramsay.
Well, exactly. It feels like, is this going to be like, am I going to have to watch Greyjoy and Bolton go head to head and go, I don't care. You know, like, I mean, so it is an odd one, right? I mean, it's like, because like
it'll be Sam versus Tommen vying against for the Iron Throne.
You know what? I actually had that funny moment like in my head last night where I was just like, yeah, what if that is just how this thing breaks down, right? Tommen and Sam becomes like his grand maester, and
Hot Pie is like master of bread.
Right. And I mean, at this point you're like, why not?
Yeah. Melisandre resurrects Dontos to be the Kingsguard. Incredible. All right. Are you prepared for questions?
I mean, no. But I shouldn't say no. I mean, I'm not prepared. I'm not like prepared. You know, I don't have.
Do you need to like go to the bathroom and look in the mirror and like
sort of psych myself up a little bit.
Yeah, like, daddy's little boy's going to do great today. Something
like that. That's exactly what it is. And, you know, one thing that never seems to be a problem is saying the word daddy in the bathroom.
Goodness. I think I'm going to give you a question here. I think you're going to do well. I think this is going to set you up well.
Okay, great.
This is from Dogwood in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Dogwood writes to me, but you'll hear your question here.
Now, is he asking why they're closing all the factories down?
She is not talking about Allentown in the famous Billy Joel song.
Got it.
But I'm sure she's familiar with that. And Dogwood, if you're not, I mean, do yourself a favor.
Couldn't that be weird? Like, I mean, if you just no idea about this song.
I mean, the piano man has dedicated an entire song to your town.
Yeah, I would think that would be like, you sing the national anthem at whatever, you know, minor league affiliate you've got, and then you immediately follow it up with Allentown.
Well, unless there's this big rivalry with Bethlehem, and they just don't want any song that mentions Bethlehem.
That's right. It's like, we don't even want to acknowledge it. And that's one of the things that, like, why Billy Joel can't play in Allentown is because they're like, look, if you want to take those words out, it's like, well, that's kind of.
No, what in that song, what happens to Bethlehem? They're building something?
In Bethlehem, they're building time?
I think that they're building time in Bethlehem.
Yeah. Is that my question?
That's why you, that's messing with some serious voodoo right there, fam.
That's my question. Because what are they building in Bethlehem? In the,
what exactly does it mean to build time?
Let me see if I can. I'm actually going to look it up. I'm going to go to my information device and see if I can.
So Dogwood, this is part of our answer to you. Will be time. It's they're, killing time.
They're killing. You know, I'm in Bethlehem. They're killing time, filling out forms, standing in line.
I see. I see. Now, for some reason, building time sounds more menacing to me than killing time.
Yeah, I mean, killing time. Obviously, that's like, you know, hey, like filibustering is
yeah,
an example,
you're
right?
Doing but, you're waiting around for nothing.
But building time seems much more like something you would expect from like Dr. Manhattan.
Exactly. Yeah, for some reason. All right, so Dogwood says, love, love, love Electric Boogaloo. Steve is my favorite pretend watch party friend. His first watch commentary has renewed my love for Game of Thrones. If you have space for this in your next Q&A, I want to ask him about his evolving relationship with the genre. Now that he has gotten into this fantasy story, is he open to others? For example, will he give House of the Dragon a try?
That's a great question. So yeah, I mean, obviously I've been a bit of a reluctant fantasy fan, I guess. I blame Willow.
Don't, you know what? Don't sleep on Willow.
I will sleep on Willow. I'm going
because
to,
that's I'll sleep that's on it Tom again. Cruise before he had the teeth fixed.
Ah, you're thinking of Legend.
Oh crap, you're right. Warwick Davis, that's right.
Val Kilmer, Joanne Whalley, before she was Joanne Whalley Kilmer. It was just not, I mean, we have such high hopes for Willow. I think Willow really ruined it for me. He has this opened my mind to maybe some more fan. I mean, maybe, I mean, like in terms of House of the Dragon, I would definitely say that I am all in on anything Game of Thrones at this point. Now, whether or not I'm willing to expand my boundaries,
so it's not a genre. It's still not a genre thing for you. You're still going to be skeptical of the genre.
Yeah, I feel like I would need another example of something else in the genre that I could go, okay, look, now this alongside Game of Thrones. Okay, this is something I'm willing to jump into. Right? I mean, it's just it's one of those things where it's like I'm somewhat maybe viewing this as the exception.
Sure.
And so I'm willing to continue down that path of the exception to see if it, you know, and who knows where that path may lead me. But I don't think I've done much in the world of fantasy beyond Game of Thrones.
Well,
other fantasy things. I mean, obviously the aforementioned Legend, mistakenly mentioned Legend, which I have seen. And again, it wasn't exactly doing
it's a nice little slice of life. I mean, it's like it's kind of fun to see Tom Cruise before the Wizards of Bethlehem built time into his DNA or whatever it was.
Yeah, crazy to think about, right? Like that he has, you know, he's now, I mean, like he's almost ageless, and I think that is
he's not human anymore. I don't think.
No, when they were in Bethlehem, when they were engineering Paul Rudd and they had a little leftover pieces, they went over into Tom Cruise's mouth.
I don't think of Paul Rudd in that way. Is he a lot older than I would think?
Oh, he's in his 50s.
Because I know that Cruise isn't he pushing 60? I think he's surpassed 60.
Well, there was a popular meme going around where they were showing Wilford Brimley side by side with Paul Rudd, and they said Paul Rudd is the age now that Wilford Brimley was in Cocoon.
That's pretty great.
And that's and I don't know, and a lot of people have used that as evidence that somehow that, you know, Paul Rudd is immortal, but I would say, look, Paul Rudd's fine. I think the issue is that we're sleeping on maybe how awful Wilford Brimley had it. Because Wilford Brimley was one of these guys, I think, that like he sold his soul to the devil and he says, hey, look, I'm going to make it so that you never age. And he says, I'll get on board with that. He says, but here's the thing. You're going to look 73 for as long as you're alive. And as a 12-year-old, he really should not have made that deal. Steve,
I don't think that I actually have evidence of his death. I don't know. Do you?
I mean, I think people just were like, I think what happened is the headline.
Because he could have just shaved his mustache and he could be anywhere.
He's Paul
Rudd. You would not recognize him.
I think what it is that the headline was Wilford Brimley, probably dead, right? And we just went with it. You know, and then another publication picked up Wilford Brimley. Yeah, he's got to be dead.
If you shave that mustache, I bet you he has vampire fangs. And I can guarantee you that is the scariest vampire you've ever encountered.
The fun fact is he doesn't like, he shaves the rest of his face around the mustache. So he just lets it grow out. So right now he just looks like a koosh ball.
This is a question for me. This is from Anonymous. I would like to put forward a candidate for your genius / badass warrior. Steve, I don't know if you're familiar with this. I put it forth my lists for I thought sort of the top 15 geniuses in the Game of Thrones universe. And the top 10 or 15 badass warriors. And my point was to say there's no name that overlaps on both lists. And that's what Martin does. He'll either give you super brains or he'll give you super badass warrior capabilities, but he won't give you both. So anyway, I've had a number of emails challenging me on this point. So this is one of those. So Anonymous says, I would like to put forward a candidate for your genius / badass warrior, Barristan Selmy. My feeling has always been that he was a wise, savvy, and yes, super smart character. He knows how to survive from Targaryen to Baratheon rule, and he doesn't make mistakes. This is best seen in the fact that he keeps his own counsel most of the time. Finally, we know that we'll be getting POV chapters from him in Winds. I would put him in the top 10 fighters and perhaps in the top 10 strategists. The latter remains to be seen, but that is my prediction. What do you think? Well, as you say, Anonymous, he keeps his own counsel. And I'll give him credit. He's certainly a survivor, but until we see those, you know, see his character arc in Winds of Winter, we won't know, but I remain open. So let's revisit this. Email me again once we get Winds, which is like 20 years from now, by AI Martin, and we will revisit the conversation then. As of now, I'm going to hold to my stance.
He's at best a candidate. You know, is that what it is?
He's at best a candidate. That's right. That's right. All right, Steve, this is for you. This is from Ian in San Diego.
San Diego.
Recently, you said that you're into chicken nuggets. Indeed, you said that you might even try the worst chicken nuggets. Mm-hmm. My question seeks to explore the other end of the spectrum. Where would you go for the best chicken nuggets?
Where would I go? So this is kind of like
I think that Ian is assuming that you don't make your own chicken nuggets.
No, I don't think I've ever tried. In fact, I don't know. I don't even know where to begin with the chicken nugget. Like,
I think you're going to have to begin with some sort of chicken puree.
So you're saying, in order to make a proper chickens, and I think you're looking at a chicken McNugget, right? Like that's your thought, is you need to take what would be chicken,
something that's chicken product and not actually get it chicken.
Get it into a paste of some sort, right? Almost like a
because
like
I think that the best thing chicken. That you would be able to do in your own home would be like a chicken finger, which to my mind is not a nugget.
Have you had pure, I guess, yeah, the idea of like a pure breast of chicken in nugget form, which is essentially like it is. It's more.
Yeah,
like
of a course I've had. I've had those, and you do certainly you would get that at, I don't know, like a Chick-fil-A, I suppose. You know, a higher
Chick-fil-A
end nugget.
Right. Yeah. Well. Yeah. The chicken fingertip, as I said, I think is probably what you're looking at. It's a chicken thumb, maybe.
Sure.
as opposed to a chicken finger. But yeah, so if you were going to have to like get into a puree or a paste like that, now that's fascinating to me. Like, cause like what, you know, like a Wendy's chicken nugget obviously is following that same sort of path. And really what it comes down to is I think it's probably the breading that's doing the work. So the trick is to get that chicken paste that has a really good, flavor, a good foundation. Whereas the breading,
and you know, why not just sprinkle in just a little bit of like, you know, that really sort of high end rat meat in there, or at least like a whisker, a rat whisker.
Yeah. See, I mean, I'm thinking it might be even just a touch more exotic. Like it might be like skunk.
Oh my.
Without knowing what skunk meat tastes like on its own, because I think you really want it to be a compliment.
I mean, I would assume it tastes a lot like possum if you are able to remove the glandular odor, a spray sack or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, you'd probably want to eat it more at the front end of the skunk meat.
Anyway, that's sort of off topic. Ian wants to know where you would go for the best nuggets.
Now is the question, where would I go or how far would I go? Because that's.
I think he says where, but I'm interested to know how far.
That's what I think, right? I mean, it's like
if I said, hey, Steve, Dayton has been voted best chicken nuggets in the country. Would you travel 4 days to come meet me for nuggets here in Dayton?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's easy. It's an easy call. I'd go pretty far, right? If I was to find out, so I'm here on the West Coast. If I was to find out that like, oh man, I tell you what, you got to go to Maine. You got to go to Maine for the best nuggets. Mm-hmm. We can't ship them. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they're not the same unless you get them fresh out the fryer. Yeah, I'll go to Maine.
All right. I do think that we're talking around Ian's question. Literally, he says, where would you go for the best chicken nuggets? And I think what he means is
he wants my recommendation.
What restaurant do you think has the best chicken? That's what I would.
Yeah,
that's how I would interpret
that. Makes
that.
Sense. That's and so again, like, are we defining? You know, do we? You kind of went and suggested that like a Chick-fil-A, where it's like all breast meat, is kind of a highfalutin nugget and maybe not a true nugget. Is that
I think
that
so. And I don't even know if Chick-fil-A calls them nuggets.
What they call them?
I don't know, man. This is a question for you. I don't know why I've been brought into this at all.
Well, because you were sort of laying down. You have, for a person who's
I'm just
not,
trying to get Ian his question answered.
For a person who's
I'm
not
advocating
nuggets, you sure have a lot of opinion on what's a real nugget. you're creating all kinds of ground rules for what these nuggets. So the Burger King had the chicken tender, if I recall. I think they did eventually go to a nugget. I'm gonna.
Did the word tender make people feel too vulnerable?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, it really. But it was a nugget. I mean, it was for sure a nugget. It was just a long nugget, which was a problem. I don't even like saying it out loud. I'm going to have to, you know what, I owe Ian some more research because it's been a while since I've like really nuggeted. Like, I'm
okay,
gonna
well,
say,
that, that's good. I'm glad. So you're going to go do some more research. You're going to go to, I don't know what, at least half a dozen nuggets from different places, and you're going to try them side by side. Now, the trouble with that is that by the time you get to that last restaurant, the first restaurant's nuggets will be cold.
Yeah, this is going to be a whole. This is going to take Cracker Jack time, and I'm going to probably have to assemble a
team.
What
we're
going to
do? Yeah, we're gonna place Steve in a sort of a central location,
exactly,
and go have advanced scouts go out so that Steve can get the optimal hot nugget experience.
Yeah. I may need to rent a helicopter. But Ian, this is for you, man. I mean, I don't like if you're out there right now just going, look, I can't wait for this episode to release because I've got a hankering. I mean, hopefully this isn't your death row meal and I'm just wasting your time. if that's the case, just go to Wendy's, get some spicy nugs and call it, and get like 37 of them. If it's your death row meal, just load up, because I tell you what, if you're getting the chair and you're in San Diego, so probably not, but who knows where you're being tried. If you do that, load up on those nuggets. When they flip that switch, you know what, it's, you kind of get the last word, if you know what I mean. And they are going to have to just throw that chair out.
I hope that is satisfying to you, Ian. This is the last question. This is from Kim in Germantown, and this is for me.
Germantown, the less popular follow-up to Allentown.
Germantown is in Ohio and actually not too far from me.
Is that right?
Yeah. I'm sure that there are other Germantowns in...
Is there a rival town also, Bethlehem?
Yeah, always the rival Bethlehem because of the Time Building. All right, so Kim asks, you have noted your love of Stranger Things alongside Game of Thrones. In fact, I think you said the two were your favorite TV shows. That's right, Kim, they are. As we know, Stranger Things is coming out with season 4. If season 4 does not live up to the hype, would you still consider covering it, or would that sour your feelings about the franchise? Well, Kim, my feeling is that if Steve and I were to cover Stranger Things, if the show went south, we would just have more fun with it. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, and that brings up an interesting point, right? Like it's certain people have, like, I think a classic example. Well, Game of Thrones has some, from everything I gather, some mixed feelings as the series goes on. But then, but like Dexter is another example, right? It takes a severe turn where everyone's like, this show sucks, right. and so. But I don't know that people have they have an affinity for it, but at the same time, you know, is it fun, right? Is it a fun experience when something that you're super excited about sort of jumps the shark? And I think Stranger Things has the potential to be more in the fun if it's bad, because I think if it goes south, it's probably going to go south. My guess is in a way that might be potentially like more like B movie-ish kind of bad, right?
Well, that's right. And Stranger Things is famously, Stranger Things is drawing from a lot of B movie tropes and intentional homages. So it would be kind of fun for me to experience that type of Stranger Things as well.
I could even probably in advance be making the argument that, oh no, that's part of it. They're doing this on purpose. This is a true homage.
So yeah, right. Clearly, Kim, like, I brought Steve on to cover Game of Thrones, him having never seen it, sort of guessing that Steve is going to have some really funny things to say about the final season, which everyone kind of gagged over. But I think Steve's really going to enjoy making fun of that, and that the misplaced endgame. That would be my guess. And so, in other words, I know something about Steve. Steve actually has this weird love for really bad media.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it could be that the worse it is, the more you love it.
That's probably accurate. And that's the same way I feel about comedy. And it's like, I want to see great comedy, or I want to see really bad comedy.
So I have a lot of fun by like introducing Steve to like movies like Penitentiary 2, famously, or The Man from Earth, which I thought was just hilariously, entertainingly bad.
Absolutely incredible.
And Steve, I think you enjoyed both of those.
Oh, immensely. I tell people to watch it and then they get mad. There was something where somebody posted one time on Facebook. They're like, "Hey, we're looking for like a family-friendly movie, you know, kids of various ages." And I said, "Oh, you want to watch Easter Bunny Puppy?" And Easter Bunny Puppy is hands down one of the most bizarre, awful films ever made.
I've never heard of it. You got to tell me about this.
I don't even know if there's an Easter theme in this movie. That's what's incredible about it. The puppy's not an Easter Bunny Puppy. He's not an Easter Puppy. I feel like there's a cat most of the time. It is fascinating. So this person, I think to this day, still holds that against me because they just watched it via my recommendation.
And so it's like, called Easter Bunny Puppy?
Yeah. And like their thought was like, well, why would he come on to my post and prank me? so angry.
All right. Well, good. So I think that listeners now have something new to explore. Now, should they watch this at Easter, or is this not something?
You know what? Here's the thing: is like, so you know, like everyone's like, "Hey, Die Hard's a Christmas movie. Easter Bunny Puppy is a Die Hard movie." anytime. That's what's great about it. You know, and if someone's like, "Well, I don't celebrate Easter from a religious standpoint," that's great. I think Easter Bunny's fine. I think it's, you know, Easter Bunny Puppy is it's a genre buster for sure.
Easter itself is sort of a genre buster.
I feel like Easter,
because it's a whole thing. It starts with Jesus.
Right.
There's no eggs involved. There's no bunnies involved.
No.
So why not add a puppy? I mean,
sure,
it's open.
And think about it. And if you look back at the Gospels, not a lot of mentions of puppies. And I'm wondering if that's probably kind of hurting the brand as the years have gone on.
You got the babies. Babies are important, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you have like people killing babies, and that famously that doesn't sell.
No. And they were smart to not have anybody killing puppies. I mean, that's sure.
Puppies, yeah. If the Bible were to bring in puppies, those puppies would absolutely die.
Right. Well, that's what we've seen with the John Wick films, right? I mean, he can kill as many people as
Jesus.
Yes.
Vengeance-filled John Wick of the first
century. That's right. Because, they killed his dog.
Pilate kills Jesus' puppy as a child.
Yeah, when they did the rewrites, they're like, you know what? Let's just crucify Jesus. There's no way we can do the dog scene.
All right. For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to widen the scope as Elio Garcia and I talk about HBO adaptations. For these developments and more, here is Martin's co-author, Elio Garcia. Famously, you know, you stopped watching after season 5.
Yeah.
But what are your... Do you have a sense of anticipation for House of the Dragon? Will you be watching? Do you have a sense that it'll be a satisfying viewing experience for you?
I will be watching, you know, different showrunner. I don't know his work very well. I've been listening to his podcast. David and Dan came to the books having it sent to them by George's agent, and they read it and they loved it and they wanted to make it. He has been a fan for much longer than, as in from before his career started. So I'd be interested to see what difference that makes to adaptation. Sure. At the same time, it's television. It's still HBO. He still has to make. So I'm looking forward to it. I'm interested in seeing it. I'm much more open to, because the story that is presented in Fire and Blood is full of alternate dueling sources telling us what happened,
right,
but aren't necessarily the same. So they have a lot of room in my mind to play with that. And it's much more thin. They create all sorts of things. So my only concern with it is, will people want to see it? Or, I mean, Game of Thrones was hugely popular, even if some people were unhappy with the end. But when it ended, did that kind of close the chapter for a while on adaptations?
Huh.
Will people kind of be like, oh, well, I've seen this before, but I want to see the next new thing.
That's my
one question. But I think HBO is certainly going to throw its resources behind it. It's going to get at least 2 seasons, probably 3, at least. And so I hope it works out really well. One of my friends is working on it. I hope it works out. Yeah, I really do. I mean, we got invited to help with the pilot for that didn't go forward, The Long Night. So we had a little involvement in that one, and we can see how complicated and difficult it is to get HBO to agree to do
Yeah, why? I'm wondering, what was the holdup there? Why didn't they go forward with The Long Night?
You know, that's a mystery. We were invited to help them develop some of the setting information that George had presented about that era.
Yeah.
To kind of come up with some things for them that they needed. And so we had a sense roughly of what they were planning to do with the show, at least in its pilot, but we don't really know if the execution was a problem. Mm. I've never spoken to George about it. I don't think he really quite knows. HBO makes decisions. It's very unusual for them to kind of pass on a pilot, though, I have to say. It's usually they, like famously with Game of Thrones, they kind of reshot half of it, basically, and gave them that chance. I think they probably just realized that. Well, I have one more theory, which has to do with season 8 and its reception.
Okay.
I have one theory there, actually. I'll say that. The Night King. Maybe ending that threat so abruptly made the story of the first Long Night.
Yeah, does anyone care about the Night King's backstory?
Yeah. That, like, maybe the way we dealt with it kind of made them realize, like, people aren't going to want to see this. I don't know. That maybe, I suspect there's a multitude of factors like that, but maybe, you know, at some point the straw that broke the camel's back happened and they said, nah, we'll pass.
Do you think that George intends to flesh out the motives of the White Walkers in a way that the show couldn't have, or just decided not to do it?
Yes. Yes, I.
Because so far the White Walkers to me are just like an avatar for Winter. You know, they're just sort of this unthinking monstrous force coming from the north. But it would be, man, it would be fascinating to learn a little bit about what are their motives, what's their culture like. You know,
long ago I was on a panel. Or I was attending a panel George was on, and he was talking about how, you know, he was tired of stories where there's like a dark lord who lives to be evil, and they just want to do evil. Like, what evil sure. do the next day? Well, and I asked George, or maybe somebody else in the room asked, well, but George, you know, what about the White Walkers? Mm-hmm. And he kind of laughed and said, well, you'll see. I don't think it's as straightforward. But and there's another thing is there's a mail from him where he was someone asked like what. What's their culture like? What is their... And George actually said, interestingly, he doesn't really see them as having culture, which is an interesting one. But I think what we'll find out is, I don't think we'll find out the motives of the White Walkers per se, even though, I mean, they have language, they have humor, because in the very first chapter, one of them laughs. It's not a nice laugh, but he found something funny. They have these swords and they have his armor. Someone must be making it. Mm-hmm. So that is culture. I don't know quite what George meant when he answered that he doesn't think they have culture. Like, they have trappings of culture that we've seen.
Right.
But what I really think is what's going to turn out is their existence has a lot to do with the Children of the Forest. And I think we will get more of that story.
Yeah.
To the degree, I mean, in my mind, they're kind of like, they were kind of like the weapon that kind of decided to do its own thing. So that kind of situation,
right? I mean, there's so avatars, yes, but avatars for sort of this magical supracultural force or something like that.
I think so, something like that. It'll be interesting. I think the sixth book, The Winds of Winter, when it arrives, whenever that may be, I think we'll start getting more of a picture of that via Bran's chapters.
Yes, probably. Yes. And Bran is in a unique position to kind of
very unique.
Give a little bit of, you know, sort almost like a godlike perspective on them.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't get into it, but I mean, going further into my idea that Varys was initially a sort of other connected figure. In A Feast for Crows, you've got the introduction of Euron Greyjoy, and his whole story, and he's a very different character in the books than what the TV show apparently should do of him. And George, I don't know if you followed, like, when George read the Aeryn chapter from The Winds of Winter, which is, let's just say, is a lot of very magical.
Yeah, he's like doing these like massive human sacrifices.
Yeah.
Now, I initially took that as sort of this Lovecraftian creatures below the deep kind of thing.
Yeah.
But he does seem connected to sort of that northern magic green scene stuff. So
yeah, that and we'll see. There was think back to the first Bran chapter after his fall.
Uh-huh.
Where he dreams it's the first time. He sees the Fiery Crow for the first time. He starts going north to the heart of winter, and he almost falls onto these spears where all these other dreamers have died.
Yes. That's
right. And the Free Eyed Crow kind of gets him out of it. And I keep wondering, like, what if Euron was a green seer born, but he had the same dream. He thought he could fly, but he got caught on those icy spears.
Mm. He's very much a Darth Vader kind of character.
Yeah, there's something of that to him. It'll be really interesting to see where George goes with him.
In the sense that, like, let's say he is a protege of Bloodraven or whatever.
Yeah. I think that's entirely possible, and then went wrong, and went very, very wrong. Right. Everything we see from him is, he's just such a horrible person.
It's kind of an amazing trick to think, you know, this grimdark world that George has created, that you could actually save the worst for last. You know,
it's like
how could anyone be worse than Ramsay Snow? And then, of course, it's like, oh, no, Euron is absolutely worse than Ramsay Snow.
No, I mean, Ramsay Snow is a very small thinker, I think, compared to. So it would be interesting to see. I think he also has one thing is about him is fans thought like they had him really figured out, like after Clash of Kings. And I recall all the speculation fans were having on our forum back years ago about like what's going to happen to Storm of Swords, and he had so many ideas that sounded like really good. Like George was going to borrow from the story, you know, King Alfred. Rob was going to get defeated, but end up hiding in the swamps of the Neck and leading a guerrilla campaign, and it's like it all made sense. Or you know, Sansa was going to get married to Willis Tyrell, and Highgarden was going to throw itself into the story, and it all made sense. And then Storm of Swords came out, and So much of it was just wrong. And it wasn't wrong because it was like wishful thinking and people fought back.
It could have plausibly worked for the story. It's just that George brought it in a different direction and it was the story he wanted to tell. So
yeah. And I mean, it's like think about like a Clash of Kings, Fionn. And that's another piece of evidence for Euron, by the way, Fionn having these prophetic dreams. When he's in Winterfell, he dreams of a king with the head of a wolf and a bloody feast on. Like, so there might be something to that, but Euron says it'll be very interesting. I really am looking forward to what he does with it.
My thanks as always to Elio, and my thanks to you who have listened this far into the Electric Boogaloo Project. And this is how season 4 ends.